I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Or welcome to the conversation I had last summer with the brilliant Simon Godwin. Here is Lights Up on Act Two. We were talking about Macbeth and how to not let the horror in the play affect you.
Gentlemen of the Stage Door Johnny Company, this is your Act Two beginners. Mr. Cake and Mr. Godwin to the stage, please. Lights Up on Act Two.
For you to be saying it's total immersion is the only way to do it, that's a lot, particularly with this play. That's a lot to live with. Do you dream about it?
I don't dream about it yet, but I know what you mean, Jonathan, and I think that I've also been working with Patrick Page, a wonderful American actor of Shakespeare and also Broadway, where he's been in Hadestown for a long time, but he just was playing King Lear with me earlier this year. And I'm working with him now on a show that he's doing, a one-man show where he plays all Shakespeare's villains in 85 minutes. And he's played Macbeth, I think, three times in his career. And he's certainly felt the impact of a character that moves into a very dark space, the darkest of all spaces, perhaps, in Macbeth. And I think of the atrocities in the play. I think of the murdering of Lady Macduff and her children and how I'm going to stage that. I mean, Yael Farber's production at the Almeida with Saoirse Ronan playing Lady Macbeth, I thought was brilliant, not least because it was really harrowing, that scene of the children being killed. And I think she delivered that with enormous lack of sentimentality and directness and unsqueamishly. So those scenes require one to be, prepared and, what would it be? Is it tough? What would be the word, do you think? Well, you've played Macbeth.
I have, yes.
Yeah, what was your experience like?
Well, I didn't... Well, I loved it so much. I mean, it's such a play of infinite depth, of course. And, you know, describing what it was like is really like describing every great part, which is that your reach always exceeds your grasp, and that's something so extraordinarily life-affirming and at the same time perennially mired in failure about it. So it's sort of both things at once. It's both the opportunity for infinite expression and a reminder that we are limited vessels, you know.
Did you find the darkness penetrating?
No, and I'll tell you why. And I think it's one of the things that I think is so extraordinary about Macbeth is because he retains the soul of this extraordinary self-reflective poet.
Yes.
You know, if he were to become the thing that his deeds would imply that he does, which is this sort of Yevgeny Prigozhin type, the guy who's the you know, recently
the
deposed
Wagner
head of the Wagner Group, exactly, in Russia. If he was just this remorseless killing machine, you cannot imagine Prigozhin having the capacity to record one of those soliloquies on his frequent postings on Telegram, you know, of intense self-recognition and extraordinary understanding. I mean, one of the amazing sleight of hand things, I think, that Shakespeare pulls off in his play is to make us still care about him, you know, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. He's still going to the end. My way of life is fallen into the sea, the yellow leaf. I mean, these are intense revelations of self-knowledge. And something about that keeps the person playing him, at least in my experience, the horror of what you're doing at bay. So complete identification, complete immersion, Have I got that right? Identification. Will you identify with the issues at the heart of the play too?
Well, I think that's interesting because I suppose identification can also lead to being glued. That one's identity is linked to that which one is making. And I think almost you have to be non-identified, but you do have to be immersed. So that's another paradox about certainty and confidence, about how am I inside something, but I remain outside as well. Because as soon as you become identified, when someone suggests a better idea than yours, you want to resist it because, hang on, that's the idea that you're critiquing is me. So then you go down the spiral, as we discussed. So what I want to do is to be immersed instead of getting to know what is in front of me as much as possible. It's studying a map, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's talking to other people who have gone on that same journey, and what are the pitfalls, and when are the times to rest, and when are the times to push on, or what can the weather be like on that ascent, and how can we be prepared as much as possible? So that's what the stage of preparation and grappling with the script. And to your point about when you edit the script, are you making dramatic or kind of curatorial decisions? I would say yes, there is also a process by which, as soon as you start to think about which lines of the witches to keep in or keep out, you have to ask yourself, well, who are the witches? Because how else will I know what to cut and what not to? So I think it's a very useful time for those thoughts. Rufus Norris had an interesting insight when he directed Macbeth, and he said after the production had come and gone, his advice to me was, don't try and solve the witches in rehearsal. You won't manage it.
Do it before.
Spend the months before, because they're too complicated and too difficult a thing to go, let's just throw around some ideas in week one or two, and by week four we'll have got the answer. Too difficult.
So, like catching Mercury,
because
they are spirits.
They are spirits, and yet the actor wants to know, who am I?
Of course.
I born? What do I want? What's my relationship to the second witch and to the first witch and to Macbeth? And all the concrete questions they rightly want answers to.
Yeah.
And I think as a director, if you say, oh, I haven't thought about that, that's less helpful.
Yeah. So you're immersed as much as you possibly can be, which begs the question, how much of the play can remain a mystery for you? How much are you okay with not knowing or understanding?
Well, I think various directors have, and I think of Michael Boyd, sadly, who has recently passed away, and his amazing work with Shakespeare. And I think he was a director that very much believed that he wanted to know much more about the play by the end than he knew at the beginning. And I think Peter Brook also says a similar thing, that he often thinks the opposite at the end of a rehearsal than he did at the start of the rehearsal about the text that he's working on. So, yeah, that's a very good question, Jonathan, about the ratio of knowledge and mystery. And there is a perfect sweet spot between knowing so much that you can not know, back to confidence and certainty. Because if I'm feeling anxious in a room that I don't know the meaning of seer, or I don't know how to pronounce scone or scoon, or is it glamis or glams, or I think then it creates a sort of cognitive dissonance in the room. When as the actor, you look to the director and you can tell that they're worried about something or they're panicking. And what they're really doing is thinking in their mind, God, I don't know, is it glamis or glams? I should have asked someone before, damn. And it takes their mind away from supporting the actor to descend into what is the philosophical question around life and death that character is trying to manifest, and how do you help the actor do that? So it's trying not to be distracted by unhelpful anxieties, so that you're so familiar as to be relaxed and then can jump into the empty space.
How are you with leaving? I don't mean now. I mean, not yet. Your immersion is obviously huge. And this sounds particularly, I mean, I suppose all productions are immensely obsessing and compelling. And maybe you'll dream about them at some point. Do you ever dream about your shows as you're doing them, or the landscape of the plays?
I think I wake up in the middle of the night thinking about them. That's probably different from dreaming about
them. The 3 a.m. things.
Yeah, we all have, definitely have that. We all do, I think.
Why are they bleak? Is there any psychological reason why they seem to be always
lonely,
catastrophizing?
I suppose we don't wake up at 3 a.m. having joyfully solved a scene.
Right.
Although sometimes there'll be moments where...
Do you have
I've
that?
Perhaps had a moment of relief. Maybe that tends to happen when cycling home after the rehearsal, or walking into the rehearsal or something. You're right. It's less the... I think the sleeplessness is to do with the interruption of a... Well, of course, the Macbeth talks about the great balm of sleep. So the place of repose being interrupted by a thought is in itself an act of violence to a natural process, perhaps explains the weakness. I'm just guessing. But in terms of, no, on the whole, I'm very happy to leave. Because the other paradox of directing is that from the first day you are preparing for your absence.
Yes.
And the very best directors are the very best at making the actors feel so self-sufficient and confident with what they're doing that they're very happy to say goodbye to the director at the school gates, as it were.
And you're always like that.
Yeah, I've always been like that. That's right. I mean, I'm in awe of Deborah Warner, who famously watches every show.
She gave me a note after our final 278th performance of Medea, after the final one.
Amazing. So for her, it's, yeah, incredible. That's a whole different experience of time. By which, I, of course, saw the Medea with you and Fiona Shaw,
yeah,
which was incredible. You were brilliant. It was a wonderful production.
Thank you. So long ago.
But I'm the opposite. I think it's not until the end, it's not until the opening night, Jonathan, that you, as a director, just realise how many times you have seen this play. And this is beyond any normal experience of a play. I mean, I might have seen it every night for the past 14 evenings, again and again and again and again. And really, I think for any sane person, seeing a play once is, on the whole, enough, maybe twice, 14 times in a row, would be testing the endurance of most of us. So, and I'm no different. I mean, and that's not including the rehearsals when I've been watching extracts of the play for maybe as long as 2 months, every day, apart from Sundays, and even then you're watching it in your mind. So, yeah, by the time opening night comes, I have this moment of radiant relief of going, oh, I get to leave the building that I've dwelt in and have loved being inside and fretted around and cared for and invested in. But now the building is made and built and I can walk away and joyfully look at the blueprint of the next one.
So if you're a good parent, you're raising your children for independence.
Absolutely.
You're raising them for the ability to be able to operate in the world without you. Casting. You're casting now. Have casted. And that must be a whole different process in itself. And you're talking to, you have a designer, I'm assuming, of course, because even though these are found spaces, you're shaping them.
Yeah.
And all these things are starting to be dialogues with other human beings. So the little world of it, which was you and Rafe, has expanded to encompass a bigger and bigger village that will then end up making the play. Is there anything that's particularly important to you in that, in these moments when you expand, when you include other people? What do you need them to share? Do you need them to share things, or do you need different ingredients?
Well, we have Indira Varma, who Rafe and I wanted to play Lady Macbeth from the beginning, who Rafe had been in Man of Superman with, which I had directed. So I had also loved working with Indira. So she came on board very quickly after the idea was born, really. So she's also been a great collaborator in all of these things. And then it's about finding actors who have a similar curiosity, urgency, who have a feeling in their life that this is something that's going to mean as much to them as it might be to us, who are willing to be on the road for 4 or 5, 6 months, who are interested in similar questions of language storytelling, who have a interest in context, backstory, and who are going to be willing to have a sense of humour about everything. And that's obviously very difficult to tell when you're meeting somebody for 15 minutes, all of those things. And so there's a huge sort of HR aspect to being a director. You're in a kind of continuous process of recruitment. Mm. And you have a casting director with you that really helps you understand maybe who people are or has seen their work if you haven't. And so as much as possible, you're trying to bring context to every single person that you meet, as much as you ever can. And then, of course, some folks will say, I don't want to come in to audition. This is an offer only. So if you want me, you have to offer me the part sight unseen, as it were. And then it becomes a very interesting gamble of, ooh, do I suggest a coffee? But in some cases, that's not going to work either. And so you just have to take the plunge. And also, I understand it. If you're an actor that's been an actor for a long period of time and has enjoyed success, why should you have to come in and do another little bit of Shakespeare to some upstart in the umbrella rooms off Shaftesbury Avenue? Surely I'm rarely asked now to do auditions to direct a play. And so actors surely have the right to feel the same. So I think it's a very understandable process, but inevitably a blind date is a tough date, or is an exhilarating date, or is a date that is more risky than the one that's come out of at least a couple of meetings.
Let's talk about the first day. What do you want from a first day of rehearsal? What do you try to do? Do you have a methodology for that? Or is it just walking in a room to find all these people you've assembled as collaborators and then winging it?
I think I have developed a strategy over the years to help me get the most out of first days. And on the whole, actually, first days are one of my favorite parts of the process now, because I think it's the day of maximum hope, that it's the day of maximum good behavior, and a really strong feeling of glad to be there, of possibility, of openness, of receptiveness, and joy to be starting off. It's the moment of meeting at the youth hostel when you've got your when you've got your bags packed and your tent is ready to go and you're setting off and there are no injuries yet and there's no meltdowns. There's just the golden future. I do tend to do icebreaking exercises that I've kind of developed over the years to help that sense of camaraderie and fun. And I suppose also feeling of mutual ownership. I think the first few days are about creating a collective feeling, a collective sense that this play is going to, success of this play depends on all of us, no matter the role that you're playing. And no matter if you're a creative team member or a stage management member or an actor, everybody's efforts count and are valued. And that, I would say, is the biggest thing that I want to convey to people in my first few days.
Is there a practical way of doing that?
Yeah, I think there's things like getting people in a circle and asking them to speak, to be in pairs, and asking them to speak for a minute on. So I'll perhaps make a long list of the themes of the play beforehand. So let's have a minute on, if it was Hamlet, you might say, let's have a minute on ghosts. And then you speak for a minute on ghosts, and then your partner speaks for a minute on ghosts, and I have a stopwatch, and then you stay where you are, and your partner moves on to the next person, and I say, and the next category is going to be, let's have a minute on fathers and sons. Go. And in this free associative exercise, which is also contained by time, people quite quickly don't have time to kind of censor themselves.
Right.
And you end up quite quickly talking about the fact that you saw a ghost last year, and or you've always been frightened of ghosts, or you love your father very much, or you find your father actually quite daunting, etc., etc. So the ways that you facilitate intimacy in a appropriate but also meaningful way.
Speaking of Hamlet, this just stuck in my head when I was reading about you. I was hearing you talk about playing Hamlet when you were 16. My son is about to turn 16. And 16 going on 17, you played Hamlet. And then, all those years later, you directed the extraordinary Papa Essie Edu in as Hamlet at the RSC and around. And I just sort of, it struck me as such a glorious preparation if you had to renounce acting, but know something of what that might be, to have walked through that door at that age in that part must sort of inform every rehearsal room you're in ever after. Did it feel like that?
Yes, actually, in a way it did. I mean, I feel very grateful as we're talking for the drama teacher, Peter Yates, that asked me to play it in the school play in St. Albans. But it certainly introduced me to Alain de Botton that created the school of life, the idea of philosophical journey that could somehow furnish you with that NAV expression, life lessons.
Yeah.
But I think that the Shakespeare is a school of life. And you spoke about the quote from Hamlet at the beginning of our chat today. And I feel very lucky to have been exposed to Shakespeare's language at that age. And the reason why I can still remember it is now the very witching time of night when churchyards yawn and hell itself breathes out contagion to this night, is because of that experience. And I do feel fed by it. I do feel like it's nutritious. And I think as I've worked so much with actors on Shakespeare, I have come to see, or at least, no, I have perhaps been evidence, or I have felt very certain of the value of Shakespeare for the life. And so when one is doing this stuff, it's not just as a entertainment for others, but it is also a vehicle of some kind for some deeper appreciation, if not understanding, of the cosmos.
Did it affect how you directed Papa?
I think it meant that I felt closer to the material. And going back to immersion, I was well prepared because I played it.
Because you immersed.
And I wasn't with him as an actor who had played it, who might have thought I was still had it in me, or I was in competition with Papa. It was a feeling of, oh, I remember a word potentially being important there, which may or may not be important to you, Papa, but let's just taste it together and see. So it just meant that I knew the music in a more freer way than if I was playing catch-up.
You talk about Shakespeare being a way of helping you understand more about life. You've directed heaps and heaps of plays, many of them new plays, some revivals, many revivals. But do you think it's fair that you are most associated with Shakespeare? That it's been the presiding playwright of your life?
Yeah, I think he was the playwright that was sort of foundational, whether I liked it or not, because it was the one that I just met when I was most young and impressionable in Hamlet. And so that has been the case, yes.
Do you ever think it's hard? By which I mean, do you think it makes it harder for you to love people who aren't Shakespeare in the same way?
That's a really interesting question, Jonathan. And I think that what I love about Shakespeare is that he's so spacious. And the amount of room he gives every collaborator to have their own associations and ideas and visions. And it's hard for any playwright to have to compete with that. The selflessness of Shakespeare, the empty space in the centre of his work, is a miracle. And he's so hospitable to everybody who approaches him. And so at times I felt other material to be less spacious. Yes, how could one not? And of course it would be sort of pompous for one not to acknowledge the greatness of other work, but whether I felt as free with other material.
Because of the space at the centre that you're allowed.
The fact that Shakespeare can be set in modern Denmark, or as with Papa in West Africa, or in a more almost futuristic world, what I directed in when I was in Japan, in Japanese. So these are just radically different landscapes with which to see these plays, or indeed fascinating to see this year Macbeth at the Globe in a modern British context. We're doing it in a sort of Russo-Ukrainian adjacent world. Again, there's just multiple lenses that one can see this.
You famously regendered Malvolio at the National Theatre in Twelfth Night into Malvolia.
Yeah.
Played by Tamsin Gregg, and completely changed the sort of politics of the identity of that play.
Yeah, and or Catherine Hunter regendering Playing and Tyler. Becoming Timon, which I directed at Stratford. So, yes, what does that mean then? I'm trying to think, Jonathan, as we're talking about the last time I directed a play, not by Shakespeare. Oh my goodness me. But I think maybe that's also why I enjoyed Shaw. Yeah. And why I enjoyed Eugene O'Neill when I directed Strange Interlude at the National Theatre, my first play at the National with Anne-Marie Duff and Jason Watkins and Charlie Edwards. And O'Neill has suddenly a vast, sprawling ambition. He's not open like Shakespeare, but his energy is immense. So perhaps it's the dramatists that have great reach that I'm most drawn to.
What's your greatest fear in the theatre?
For me or for the art form?
No, for you.
Unemployment.
Do you fear unemployment?
Yes,
I think... You're one of the most employed people I've ever met.
Well, Jonathan, you're very sweet. So when we spoke earlier about leaving my job in Northampton and doing my 2 years of physical training in London and emerging from that, as I did when I was 31. And that was a very stark moment of Rupert had predicted that I would never come back, and I had left my 2 years of training and I had no job. And I had no money, and this was a problem. And there was a little voice that said to me, but I was once somebody. Does people not know that I've left my 2 years and I am now back? Why is the phone singularly not ringing at all ever? And this realization came to me that, no one has ever asked me to be a theatre director. The same way no one has ever asked an artist to become an artist. To be an artist is to propose things to the world and hope that they will resonate. And if they do not resonate, then that is to do with you and not the world. So that feeling of it's on me was the catalyst to buy my stage newspaper and look through it and find at the back a small advert for the Tabard Pub Theatre's production of A Christmas Carol, Director Wanted, and led me to send in my CV and have an interview with Colin at the Tabard Theatre and get the job directing four people with a keyboard player in the Christmas production of A Christmas Carol above the theatre. It was entirely unglamorous. It couldn't have been less glamorous, but I really enjoyed it. And afterwards, after the modest success of A Christmas Carol, they asked what I would like to do next. And I said, as I look back now, I'm very impressed that I managed to persuade them. I mean, it's a terrific play, but it's not a commercial play. It was The Country by Martin Crimp.
Yeah.
And they said, all right. So I did the play and Martin came to see it and he was very kind. And Dominic Cook came to see it, who was then running the Royal Court. And then I got invited to direct a reading of a new play at the court, which, to cut a long story short, ended up me eventually working there full time. But we're only a few steps away from the Tabard. And every day I have to think about, not every day, but frequently I think about, right, what would happen if I lost everything? Or what would happen if I was back there? Or those moments of professional frustration, or why aren't I doing X, Y, Z? And then coming back to this feeling of, it's on me. I've got to be the proposer. No one has ever asked me to do this. I'm here because I believe in it and I want to do it. That does help me as I contemplate what would happen if the phone didn't ring again. It's always has been and always will be on me.
That's extraordinary and very lovely. When do you remember being happiest in the theatre?
Well, I think for me on the whole, rehearsals are a happy environment. I think if they're going as they should, they are a happy space. And I love it when you are doing something and the unexpected does emerge. So, for example, directing Patrick Page in King Lear earlier this year, the realisation, growing realisation, that there was a lot of humour in King Lear, which I genuinely had no idea before I started working on it. And I don't think Patrick had either. And this feeling of, ooh, a trust sort of developing in which something, which I think he was thinking was pretty counterintuitive in me asking him to play lines in a way that would perhaps encourage or lean into the wit of this king, was at the start very odd for him and somewhat baffling. But then there was an exquisite moment when he kind of thought, well, okay, I'll give it a try. I mean, maybe this guy knows what he's doing. Like, and he stepped in, and then we both stepped into the stream and the river, and his King Lear became very idiosyncratic and actually more moving and more piercing for having the self-awareness to be funny as well as to be savage and terrifying and self-pitying and visionary as all the things that King Lear is. So I love that return to Thomas's mischievous upturning of convention to discover the truly idiosyncratic. That's what makes me most happy.
Last question. Apart from the unexpected and apart from employment, what do you still want from the theatre?
I think what I want from the theatre is a feeling of community. Community of artists and a community of audience. I think of the golden runs, golden periods of certain theatre companies or theatres over the last 400 years and think about there were this sort of, if you could find creative momentum in a certain context with a community that's willing to show up, to buy tickets, to help you find the resources that you need, a creative team and a set of actors that are willing to keep coming back, to go deeper into the material and to encourage and push each other to travel more profoundly into shared questions, and the sense that camaraderie creates true confidence. That's what I'm looking for.
I really, really hope you find it, and I hope I can find it with you.
Yes,
thank
please.
You, Simon. I love talking to you.
And I feel the same, Jonathan. Thank you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
All right, the glass of theatrical champagne that is Simon Godwin has exited the stage door, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Simon, so much for giving me that time. How wonderfully insightful and brilliantly interesting he is about the way his life affects his directing and his directing affects his life. And now, of course, having given us that intro, I sort of do want to be sharing scotch with him in Cawdor Castle, talking more about theatre and Macbeth. I think it sounds like something we should do, so perhaps we'll try to. Thanks again, Simon. It was just a joy to see you again and to talk to you. Thank you, too, to my brilliant producer, Ben Backhouse. Thank you to the musicians, Iggy and Phoebe Cake, Iggy for writing, Phoebe and playing, and Phoebe for singing. And thank you to Julianne Nicholson, my wonderful stage manager, for your dulcet tones. Thank you to you for listening. Now, next week, my guests are the coolest power couple in theatre, according to Vogue magazine. They are generation-defining playwright Jez Butterworth and his leading lady in life and art, Laura Donnelly. They're currently collaborating on Jez's play Hills of California, which is at the Harold Pinter Theatre in London as I speak, which is in March, I think playing through till the middle of June 2024. And it is a doozy of a play. And I spoke to Jez and Laura live on stage at the Jermyn Street Theatre, and I hope that you'll join me for my chat with them next week.
Stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. Not a line rhymes with Johnny, but here it is. Stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. He sits in the balcony. Sees plays sad and funny. That's stage door. Stage door Johnny. He knows that there's no money. Being stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.